Chapter 8. When he could readily eat it all, was a problem in which the reasonableness of a larger and larger quantity argued itself inversely as a smaller and smaller quantity remained. When, at length, he had finally decided on a terminal point in the body of the bird, the door was gently opened. "Oh, you have not finished?" ... came to him over his shoulder, in a considerate voice. "Oh yes, thank you, Lady Constantine," he said, jumping up. "Why did you prefer to lunch in this awkward, moldy place?" "I thought it would be better," said Swithin simply. "There is fruit in the other room, if you like to come. But perhaps you would rather not?" "Oh yes, I should much like to," said Swithin, walking over his napkin, and following her as she led the way to the adjoining apartment. Here, while she asked him what he had been reading, he modestly ventured on an apple, in whose flavor he recognized the familiar taste of old friends robbed from her husband's orchards in his childhood, long before Lady Constantine's advent on the scene. She supposed he had confined his search to his own sublime subject, astronomy? Swithin suddenly became older to the eye, as his thoughts reverted to the topic thus reintroduced. "Yes," he informed her. "I seldom read any other subject. In these days the secret of productive study is to avoid, well, did you find any good treatises?" None. "The theories in your books are almost as obsolete as the Ptolemaic system. Only fancy, that magnificent cyclopedia, leather-bound, and stamped, and gilt, and wide-margined, and bearing the blazon of your house in magnificent colors, says that the twinkling of the stars is probably caused by heavenly bodies passing in front of them in their revolutions. And is it not so? That was what I learned when I was a girl." The modern Eudoxus now rose above the embarrassing horizon of Lady Constantine's great house, magnificent furniture, and awe-inspiring footmen. He became quite natural, all his self-consciousness fled, and his eye spoke into hers no less than his lips to her ears, as he said, "How such a theory can have lingered unto this day beats conjecture. François Rago, as long as 40 or 50 years ago, conclusively established the fact that scintillation is the simplest thing in the world, merely a matter of atmosphere. But I won't speak of this to you now. The comparative absence of scintillation in warm countries was noticed by Humboldt. Then, again, the scintillations vary. No star flaps his wings like Sirius when he lies low. He flashes out emeralds and rubies, amethyst and flames and sapphire colors, in a manner quite marvelous to behold, and this is only one star. So too, do Arcturus, and Capella, and lesser luminaries. But I tire you with this subject? On the contrary, you speak so beautifully, that I could listen all day." The astronomer threw a searching glance upon her for a moment, but there was no satire in the warm, soft eyes which met his own with a luxurious contemplative interest. "Say some more of it to me," she continued, in a voice not far removed from coaxing. After some hesitation the subject returned again to his lips, and he said some more indeed, much more. Lady Constantine, often throwing in an appreciative remark or question, often meditatively regarding him, in pursuance of ideas not exactly based on his words, and letting him go on as he would. Before he left the house the new astronomical project was set in train. The top of the column was to be roofed in, to form a proper observatory, and on the ground that he knew better than anyone else how this was to be carried out, she requested him to give precise directions on the point, and to superintend the whole. A wooden cabin was to be erected at the foot of the tower, to provide better accommodation for casual visitors to the observatory than the spiral staircase and lead flat afforded. as this cabin would be completely buried in the dense fir foliage which enveloped the lower part of the column and its pedestal, it would be no disfigurement to the general appearance. Finally, a path was to be made across the surrounding fallow, by which she might easily approach the scene of her new study. When he was gone, she wrote to the firm of opticians concerning the equatorial for whose reception all this was designed. The undertaking was soon in full progress, and by degrees it became the talk of the hamlets round that Lady Constantine had given up melancholy for astronomy, to the great advantage of all who came in contact with her. One morning, when Tabitha Lark had come as usual to read, Lady Constantine chanced to be in a quarter of the house to which she seldom wandered, and while here she heard her maid talking confidentially to Tabitha in the adjoining room on the curious and sudden interest which Lady Constantine had acquired in the moon and stars. "They do say all sorts of trumpery," observed the handmaid. "They say, though, 'tis little better than mischief. To be sure, that it isn't the moon, and it isn't the stars, and it isn't the planets, that my lady cares for, but for the pretty lad who draws them down from the sky to please her, and being a married example, and what with sin and shame knocking at every poor maid's door afore you can say, 'Hands off, my dear,' to the civilest young man, she ought to set a better pattern." Lady Constantine's face flamed up vividly. "If Sir Blount were to come back all of a sudden, oh, my!" Lady Constantine grew cold as ice. "There's nothing in it," said Tabitha scornfully. "I could prove it any day." "Well, I wish I had half her chance." Sighed the lady's maid. And no more was said on the subject then. Tabitha's remark showed that the suspicion was quite in embryo as yet. Nevertheless, saying nothing to reveal what else he had overheard, immediately after the reading Lady Constantine flew like a bird to where she knew that Swithin might be found. He was in the plantation, setting up little sticks to mark where the wooden cabin was to stand. She called him to a remote place under the funereal trees. "I have altered my mind," she said. "I can have nothing to do with this matter." "Indeed?" said Swithin, surprised. "Astronomy is not my hobby any longer. And you are not my astronomer royal." "O Lady Constantine!" Cried the youth, aghast. "Why, the work is begun. I thought the equatorial was ordered." She dropped her voice, though a Jericho shout would not have been overheard. "Of course astronomy is my hobby privately, and you are to be my astronomer royal, and I still furnish the observatory, but not to the outer world. There is a reason against my indulgence in such scientific fancies openly, and the project must be arranged in this wise. The whole enterprise is yours. You rent the tower of me. You build the cabin. You get the equatorial. I simply give permission, since you desire it. The path that was to be made from the hill to the park is not to be thought of. There is to be no communication between the house and the column. The equatorial will arrive addressed to you, and its cost I will pay through you. My name must not appear, and I vanish entirely from the undertaking. This blind is necessary," she added, sighing. "Goodbye. But you do take as much interest as before, and it will be yours just the same?" He said, walking after her. He scarcely comprehended the subterfuge, and was absolutely blind as to its reason. "Can you doubt it? But I dare not do it openly." With this she went away. And in due time there circulated through the parish an assertion that it was a mistake to suppose Lady Constantine had anything to do with Swithin St. Cleaver his stargazing schemes, as he had merely allowed him to rent the tower of her for use as his observatory, and to put some temporary fixtures on it for that purpose. After this Lady Constantine lapsed into her former life of loneliness, and by these prompt measures the ghost of a rumor which had barely started into existence was speedily laid to rest. It had probably originated in her own dwelling, and had gone but little further. Yet, despite her self-control, a certain north window of the great house, that commanded an uninterrupted view of the upper 10 feet of the column, revealed her to be somewhat frequently gazing from it at a rotundity which had begun to appear on the summit. To those with whom she came in contact she sometimes addressed such remarks as, "Is young Mr. St. Cleeve getting on with his observatory? I hope he will fix his instruments without damaging the column, which is so interesting to us as being in memory of my dear husband's great-grandfather, a truly brave man." On one occasion her building steward ventured to suggest to her that, Sir Blount having deputed to her the power to grant short leases in his absence, she should have a distinctive agreement with Swithin, as between landlord and tenant, with a stringent clause against his driving nails into the stonework of such an historical memorial. She replied that she did not wish to be severe on the last representative of such old and respected parishioners as St. Cleeve's mother's family had been, and of such a well-descended family as his father's, so that it would only be necessary for the steward to keep an eye on Mr. St. Cleeve's doings. Further, when a letter arrived at the great house from Hilton and Pimm's, the opticians, with information that the equatorial was ready and packed, and that a man would be sent with it to fix it, she replied to that firm to the effect that their letter should have been addressed to Mr. St. Cleeve, the local astronomer, on whose behalf he had made the inquiries, that he had nothing more to do with the matter, that he would receive the instrument and pay the bill, her guarantee being given for the latter performance. Lady Constantine then had the pleasure of beholding a wagon, laden with packing cases, moving across the field towards the pillar, and not many days later Swithin, who had never come to the great house since the luncheon, met her in a path which he knew to be one of her promenades. "The equatorial is fixed, and the man gone," he said, half in doubt as to his speech, for her commands to him not to recognize her agency or patronage still puzzled him. "I respectfully wish you could come and see it, Lady Constantine." "I would rather not. I cannot." "Saturn is lovely. Jupiter is simply sublime. I can see double stars in the Lion and in the Virgin, where I had seen only a single one before. It is all I required to set me going. I'll come. But you need say nothing about my visit. I cannot come tonight, but I will sometime this week. Yet only this once, to try the instrument. Afterwards you must be content to pursue your studies alone." Swithin seemed but little affected at this announcement. "Hilton and Pim's man handed me the bill," he continued. "How much is it?" he told her. "And the man who has built the hut and dome, and done the other fixing, has sent in his." He named this amount also. "Very well. They shall be settled with. My debts must be paid with my money, which you shall have at once, in cash, since a check would hardly do. Come to the house for it this evening. But no, you must not come openly, such is the world. Come to the window that is exactly in a line with the long snowdrop bed, in the south front at 8 tonight, and I will give you what is necessary." "Certainly, Lady Constantine," said the young man. At 8 that evening accordingly, Swithin entered like a specter upon the terrace, to seek out the spot as he had designated. The equatorial had so entirely absorbed his thoughts, that he did not trouble himself seriously, to conjecture the why and wherefore of her secrecy. If he casually thought of it, he set it down in a general way to an intensely generous wish on her part not to lessen his influence among the poorer inhabitants, by making him appear the object of patronage. While he stood by the long snowdrop bed, which looked up at him like a nether Milky Way, the French casement of the window opposite softly opened, and a hand beordered by a glimmer of lace was stretched forth, from which he received a crisp little parcel, banknotes, apparently. He knew the hand, and held it long enough to press it to his lips, the only form which had ever occurred to him of expressing his gratitude to her without the encumbrance of clumsy words, a vehicle at the best of times, but rudely suited to such delicate merchandise. The hand was hastily withdrawn, as if the treatment had been unexpected. Then, seemingly moved by second thoughts, she bent forward and said, "Is the night good for observations?" Perfect. She paused. "Then I'll come tonight," she at last said. "It makes no difference to me, after all. Wait just one moment." He waited, and she presently emerged, muffled up like a nun, whereupon they left the terrace and struck across the park together. Very little was said by either till they were crossing the fallow, when he asked if his arm would help her. She did not take the offered support just then, but when they were ascending the prehistoric earthwork, under the heavy gloom of the fir trees, she seized it, as if rather influenced by the oppressive solitude than by fatigue. Thus they reached the foot of the column, 10,000 spirits in prison seeming, to gasp their griefs from the funereal boughs overhead, and a few twigs scratching the pillar with the drag of impish claws as tenacious as those figuring in St. Anthony's Temptation. "How intensely dark it is just here," she whispered. "I wonder you can keep in the path. Many ancient Britons lie buried there, doubtless." He led her round to the other side, where, feeling his way with his hands, he suddenly left her, appearing a moment after with a light. "What place is this?" she exclaimed. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.